The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Federal Centers for Disease Control has released an updated estimate of the number of overdose deaths in the U.S. in 2020. According to the CDC, a total of 93,398 people died from a drug overdose that year. That's not the final figure. Those data won't be finalized for several months, so the number for 2020 could climb a little higher. The data also appear to show that overdose deaths are continuing to climb into 2021. Activists in the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, are organizing to save lives by opening a supervised consumption site. Legislators in that state are also working to pass a bill providing legal cover. Unfortunately, as politicians debate, people die. So Somerville residents are moving forward in advance of state action. Later on today's show, we'll hear from some of them. But first, the San Diego Sheriff's Department is the latest law enforcement agency to push the myth that an officer can overdose by merely being in the presence, practically speaking, of any amount of fentanyl. The San Diego Sheriff's Department recently released a video of an officer who they claim had suffered an overdose by being exposed to a powder containing fentanyl. The department even released an edited body cam video of the deputy keeping his eyes closed while being given Narcan. The problem is that it's not possible. I mean, there is technology to allow fentanyl to be absorbed through the skin. It's called a transdermal patch. And you need that technology because just putting some on your hand or on your skin isn't enough. There's actually quite a lot of research about this. It is possible to absorb fentanyl through the nose, if you honk up a line of it, but incidental exposure through the air is highly unlikely. And it didn't happen in this case. I mean, the only real question here is, did that deputy have a panic attack and faint? Or was this just a really bad amateur dramatic production from the get-go? Personally, I vote for the latter. It's the four rules of police. These are based on attorney Bruce Harvey's original three rules. Rule number one, cops lie. Rule number two, cops always lie. Rule number three, cops always lie about drugs. And my own personal rule number four, cops always lie about bloody everything. Now, regarding fentanyl, go to drugpolicyfacts.org. Check out the section on fentanyl. There are full citations for each item at Drug Policy Facts with links to the original source materials. We want you to check the source and do further reading for yourselves. And read what the toxicologists have to say. Read the journals. Don't just look at the press release. Well, of course, this is radio, so we need some audio, right? Here's Dr. Ryan Marino. He's an emergency physician and medical toxicologist who's medical director of the Toxicology and Addiction Medicine Bridge Clinic at University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah, so I think fentanyl myths and misconceptions have really kind of taken on a life of their own, and without including them in the conversation around fentanyl, we're kind of doing a disservice here. So in my role in the emergency department, I can't say how valuable fentanyl is to me as a medication. In treating pain, it's much more favorable in its effect profile than a lot of other opioids we use. And it's just overall kind of a great and indispensable medicine. But what I've seen recently, and probably increasing over recent years, is I will actually have patients now who come in, I mean, maybe with a broken bone kind of poking out through their skin, are turning down fentanyl. They don't want their pain well controlled. They don't want kind of a safe and well-established drug. And this is because of these myths that there are. And so it's probably almost every day, at least once a week, that we're hearing some sort of report. Someone is touching fentanyl, going down. There's some law enforcement officer who was performing a routine traffic stop and had all of these horrible things happen to them. And the only way they got better was they gave themselves Narcan or naloxone, the antidote. But the problem is that none of this is true fentanyl toxicity. And so in my role as a medical toxicologist is knowing kind of how drugs work and understanding the pharmacokinetics, the chemical properties. And so fentanyl does not absorb well through the skin. There is a fentanyl patch that's available on the market as a medicine. And this is not necessarily fentanyl per se. It's fentanyl mixed into a solution. It takes more than 13 hours to reach steady state concentrations in the human body, which would be a therapeutic dose, not even an overdose. And again, we're talking more than 13 hours, and something that is not actually just fentanyl. And there's also this myth that it kind of gets into the air and can aerosolize, and fentanyl, based on its physical properties and chemical properties, does not do that well. And this is kind of played out into the scenario that this could become a weapon of mass destruction. And we have not seen this successfully weaponized, with the exception of one very questionable incident in Russia. These drugs just do not work like that. And so me and some other collaborators actually looked at the role of misinformation. And just from May through December of 2019, there were 551 news reports in the United States that we found putting out misinformation about touching or inhaling fentanyl. And of these 551 articles, which is about two a day, I think, based on that short time period, there were 70 million Facebook shares, or 70 million Facebook users were reading or exposed to those articles. And inaccurate statements from government sources were actually shared 10 times more than accurate sources on fentanyl. And so other people have looked at this phenomenon as well. And while these people are having true symptoms, it's more likely to be a result of kind of the fear and the scare tactics, the overall kind of boogeyman of the day that fentanyl has become. And looking at these law enforcement officers, whoever has reported these symptoms, there's never been any testing that showed any fentanyl was in their system. People have done a very conclusive job at looking at the symptoms that are reported, and they're usually actually the opposite of kind of opioid toxicity, where people get rapid rates of breathing. And we know that opioids suppress your breathing, increased heart rate, palpitations, anxiety, fear, these kind of things that we actually use opioids to treat in people who are at end of life or having kind of severe medical issues. We can use opioids to make you not have fear, to make you not worry about your breathing. And so none of this is consistent with opioid toxicity. This myth is really out of control. And for whatever reason, it keeps getting put forth as kind of fact, when the facts show that it actually is the opposite and is totally incorrect and false.
That was Dr. Ryan Marino, an emergency physician and medical toxicologist who's medical director of the Toxicology and Addiction Medicine Bridge Clinic at University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio. He spoke on a panel back in March that was organized by the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. As I mentioned at the top of the show, advocates and harm reductionists in the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, are working to save lives by opening a legal supervised consumption site. The city has been holding town hall meetings on the issue. The most recent was August 12th. Here's Somerville Mayor Joseph Curtatone.
Thanks. Thank you, Doug. And thank you, everyone who tuned in this evening, who will be watching this later, for being engaged, for asking questions, and for doing two things we've asked you to do from the very beginning. It's not to make a decision or believe anything we say up the bat, but to read the information, look at the data, and have an open mind and an open heart. The only impact we see is positive in our community, and the data, as you hear, and the information and the statistics all point that out. Positive to keeping people healthy, safe, and alive. And when we have a healthy community, we have a happy community, a productive community. Positive in a way that when people truly believe a community allows authentically people to live a healthy, safe, and sustainable life there, it means positive impacts for our neighborhoods and our local economy. And all the data and all the information you'll hear, we want to hear your questions, will point to that. You know, the misinformation about it's a detriment to business, or drive business away, or it increases crime, that is all proven to not be true, not be accurate, but we ask you, you know, just take our word for it, to look at the information, ask questions of it, because that is undoubtedly not the case. What we know and why Somerville is, we are not immune to the scourge of overdose deaths and addiction. It is a health crisis. And I can think of no greater responsibility as a civil and compassionate society than to make sure we do everything like we are during a pandemic to keep our friends and neighbors and our fellow residents and citizens safe. For far too long in this nation, we've had a silent, incremental approach to overdose, the overdose and addiction crisis. And we seem to take homage and pride in Massachusetts, for example, that when we say, well, we didn't have more than 2,000 deaths as a result of overdose this year, we had 1,800. And that's good news. Now, that's still awful news. There was still thousands of lives we could have saved every year with proven health methods that reduce harm and risk. For full disclosure, if you haven't heard me say this before, I was on the opposite side of this argument very explicitly. And I have this addiction in my family. It seemed counterintuitive to me. You know, how could this help? Doesn't this drive addiction? But what drove me were the facts, the data, the science, and the results and proven methods in other parts of, not far from us in Canada, but we've seen in areas and neighborhoods and districts where they've had an implementation strategy, a 35% plus decrease in overdose deaths, and as great of increase in people seeking help for their addiction. So that's why I say why Somerville, and I'd say also why not every municipality in every state in this nation. We don't need a piloting strategy. We need an implementation strategy. We have supervised consumption sites happening right now. The stories we hear, for the calls we get from parents saying, I am watching, I bought Narcan. My son or daughter or brother or loved one take their narcotics they're addicted to or their substance they're addicted to just so I'm there to save them. We've heard from those in the addiction community who said to us, we don't want to die. You know, we want to be safe. And this is a health crisis. It is, we need to be treating this like a disease and crisis that it is and destigmatizing people who didn't choose to become addicted. I don't know anyone when they're in kindergarten or first grade, when your teacher asked you, what do you want to be when you grow up? They said, I think I'm going to be an addict. These are members of our community, like me, the loved ones. So many of you, I'm sure, connected or know someone, I've had many friends throughout my life who have battled addiction, have succumbed to it, did everything they could. And so why some of them, like I would say anyone else, it's our collective responsibility, not to abdicate that responsibility, to do everything we can to reduce harm and risk and keep everyone safe. When we do that, we're happy, we're healthy, we're productive, we're more prosperous. And when we live up to those values, people pay attention. We've done that all along. So I thank you for coming out tonight. I look forward to your questions. Please ask your questions. We want to answer them. We want you to have all the information. And I ask you once again, please keep an open mind and an open heart. I know you will. Thanks, Doug.
That was Somerville, Massachusetts Mayor Joseph Curtatone. He was speaking at an August 12th town hall meeting on opening a supervised consumption site in that city. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Melanie Renault is from Montreal, Quebec. She owns a cafe near a supervised consumption site there.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here today with you. I think it's really important to talk about this. The center has been really a good, positive addition to the neighborhood. It was really good for the cafe. The cafe opened in September 2013, and the supervised injection site opened in November 2017. So we had 4 years before, and then since then, it's been almost 4 years already since it opened. So I can tell you that it has had a very positive impact on the business. Prior to the center opening, we had on a semi-regular basis, maybe at least once a month, people shooting up in our bathroom at the cafe. It was always a really difficult position to be in, to kind of have to judge the person that's asking to go to the bathroom. But we knew that it was also sometimes a reality of what would happen in the bathroom. Since the center has opened in 2017, we've never had that issue again in the bathroom at the cafe. So that was already one mega positive change. The center where they opened the injection site is a center that already existed in the neighborhood to help people in difficulty or in the streets. And they added the injection center next to it. So since we've had them next door, they're literally like two doors down. They're really, really close to our cafe. Since they've been open, it's been also a really nice resource center. Like if we have people coming in that are looking for like some food or a coffee, they also have a day center that's available. So they can also just go and hang out somewhere, which is really nice, especially in the winter time when it's way tougher out in the streets. So since we've had the center opening, there was concern at the beginning before the center opened, definitely in the neighborhood, especially from some parents, because there is a school close by and a few centers where like kids go a lot. So there was concern from the parents about how it would impact to have this the site there. Like people were thinking maybe there'll be like more I don't really like using this term, but like sketchy people hanging around the area. So that was a concern for the parents. The people from the center did meet with the parents as big discussions, and it's all been done in a really safe, safe way. What's also been really good is they've have teams that go walk around the neighborhood and pick up any syringes or anything that might be hanging around that could be harmful to the kids. So they have a lot of resources. It's not just the injection center, but it has a lot of like different things that fall from that. So the worries since then, there hasn't been any more worries from the schools. It's kind of making the people more concentrated around the injection site. So sometimes in the morning, there'll be like some people hanging around outside waiting for it to open. It is a daytime center that we have next to the cafe. I know some others are all night long or nighttime, but ours is during the daytime. And there is, I don't know how many people they have going on a daily basis, but the people going there, it doesn't affect the cafe. I mean, they'll rarely come into the cafe. They won't come and, for example, like ask for money or things like that. Which before we had way more like people coming in and trying to either ask for some help or different things like that, which was always a bit of an awkward situation because you don't want to obviously refuse to help someone, but at the same time you've got the clients in the cafe sometimes with families and things like that, so you want to make sure also that everybody is in a safe environment. But since it's open, it's seriously been a really good thing. And what we're doing also very soon is doing a training, a workshop with the employees that's done through the injection site to learn techniques and tips on how to discuss with people that might be high or that might be in a certain situation that they're not doing really well. So that's a free workshop that's given also by the injection site, which I find is a really nice bonus for all the businesses around in the neighborhood. What else can I tell you? We also had, before they opened, they had an open house so they could show us what it looks like. So all the businesses were invited to go and take a look at the center. And they've been really, really good at being in touch with all the businesses as well to discuss if there was any issues or anything like that. So they're really also involved in the community. So personally, I can say that it's really been positive. And a few times where we might have had some issues with people that came in and we tried to ask them to leave nicely and it wouldn't work. Well, sometimes we just went next door and got someone who's trained in that department basically to come and help us, you know. So that's also been a very positive aspect to have that resource as well. Closer to us than it might have been in the past. So that's also been quite a positive aspect to it.
That was Melanie Renault. She's a cafe owner in Montreal whose business is near a supervised consumption site there. Now here's Michael Pissaferri from the government of Quebec.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that, Doug. And it's a pleasure to see Mayor Curtatone on the line as well. So I'm Doug had introduced me, I'm Michael Pizzaferri. I work with the Quebec government here in Boston. So we represent the Quebec provincial government and the six New England states. And one of our roles, really, as a neighbor, we border three U.S. states, or four U.S. states, sorry, three of them are here in New England. We only border two Canadian provinces. So working with you and working with the city of Somerville, working with the states here in New England is part of our daily existence. It's part of being a good neighbor. We in Quebec have had safe injection sites in the city of Montreal, where Melanie is based, since 2017. Currently, there are three fixed physical locations where you can visit a safe injection services. And there's one mobile unit as well. And so those sites have been in place since 2017. And I can confirm what Melanie has shared, what the mayor had mentioned, and what Doug has shared as well. These sites have saved lives of the people in our province, and they have saved lives for people across Canada as well. And the philosophy behind that for us is what we call harm reduction. We were already, since the 1980s in Quebec, doing needle exchange programs, as an example, and meeting with one of our experts who wrote the policy for the province, you know, where he often cited this as an example, is you have somebody and you share a needle with them, but then you're putting your head in the sand as to what they do next. And for him and for our Ministry of Health, offering safe injection and safe consumption services was part of our health strategy. It's part of keeping our people healthy, part of keeping our people safe in the same way that a needle exchange program is. And so that's where that growth and push for safe injection service in Montreal first began. It was this desire to grow the full suite of services that are offered to some of the most vulnerable people in our population. What I can share as well, and Melanie mentioned this and Doug, you recapped this quite well, is that the safe consumption services are not just a resource for drug users in the community. They're a resource for business owners. They're a resource for all of the residents of the community where they open up. And I'm happy to connect with those and with the city of Somerville after this to share some of our other experience and some of the data we've collected. I know as a resident of Boston myself, the mass and cast issue is currently very much in the news. And one of the big questions that we get all the time is, what does this result in a concentration of services? Do people travel to use these? And the experience in Montreal is no. There's a very small limit to what people are willing to travel to do in our experience. And typically these services in the neighborhoods where they are located are used by the people who are already in that neighborhood primarily. And then mobile unit is used to serve other areas of the city that may not be served by a fixed location. And I'll just close on this briefly in terms of how this works on the federal level in Canada versus how it works on the provincial level. And I know this is a city that's hoping to open it up. And so I won't speak for Massachusetts, but what happened in Canada, the first sites opened in Vancouver in the province of British Columbia. Montreal was the second city in Canada to have safe injection services in 2017. What the federal government has done in Canada is grant an exemption to these services for the use of otherwise illegal substances at these locations, but they do not otherwise have involvement in regulating the services or providing funding. It's all done at the provincial level. And during the pandemic, we've actually seen the opening, because there has been an epidemic of opioid use going alongside the COVID-19 pandemic. And so there have been some services that have opened during the pandemic, granted that exemption from the provincial level or from the federal level, and then given the funding needed to open from the provincial government. And so that's something that is currently being done by the provincial Ministry of Health. And a new site opened last year in Quebec City, which is the capital of the province and is a smaller city than Montreal. It's got a metro population of about 2 million. And these services are actually open all across Canada now. So it's not just in Quebec or British Columbia. And I will just share, I don't know if Melanie has visited Somerville, but maybe I'll just close on this. But the neighborhood where her cafe is based actually reminds me a lot of Davis Square. I have to be honest. I visited quite a bit. I don't know what the location is for, plans in Somerville, but you know, the neighborhood is quite similar in that sense, and very similar cultural vibes, and a really great neighborhood of Montreal that, as the visitors who we took to visit these sites could attest, you would never know that the site is there. And something that our director of harm reduction policy often mentions is that there's a bar, like a nightclub sort of thing, right near one of the services in Montreal. And the police are called far more frequently for complaints in the neighborhood to that bar than they have ever been to the safe injection site that's located right next door. And I think that story speaks volumes. And I've heard more than just from Melanie about business owners that are supportive of these services having opened up in their city. So I won't be able to stay on for the Q&A, but Doug does have my contact information, and we will do our best, as I said, as neighbors, to be supportive of this process here in New England and provide what we've learned. We have not opened them because we're somehow better or more advanced or anything like that. We face the same crisis that folks in Massachusetts have faced, that folks in Somerville have faced, and we found a possible solution to this. And so we're happy to share any way we can help to our neighbors and best practices on the next steps in this process. So thank you all, and thank you for having us for this, and thank you for this work as well.
That was Michael Pisaferri with the Quebec government. He was participating in a town hall meeting in Somerville, Massachusetts. They were discussing the establishment of a supervised consumption site in Somerville. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. While we have time, here's Doug Kress, Director of Health and Human Services for the City of Somerville.
But one thing I want to remind us is that what is a supervised consumption site? And they're also referred to as a supervised injection facility, drug consumption room, or an overdose prevention site. But these are hygienic environments where individuals can bring pre-obtained drugs to use under the supervision of a healthcare professional, somebody who is trained, that can respond with oxygen, naloxone, or Narcan, as many of us know about this, in the event of an overdose, to prevent that overdose. They also provide a variety of other support services tied to these types of services. Melanie mentioned a few of those during her presentation, but we know that one of the things that we want to do is we want to make sure that a facility here in Somerville, or any facility that were to be open, that it's something that individuals who want to consume will use this site. We don't just want to build it without their input. We do not want to create this without people in our neighborhoods being part of that decision and that process to really understand the idea of this. I want to remind us that the first sanctioned SCS supervised consumption site was established in Switzerland back in 1986. And there are now over 120 sites located in 11 different countries. While they operate under a range of models, they really are part of a larger continuum of care for people who use drugs and seek to connect with individuals who may or may not be readily engaged with other existing healthcare sites and other healthcare settings. So this is an important piece to really make sure that there are those connections.
That was Doug Kress, Director of Health and Human Services for the City of Somerville. Doug facilitated the Somerville Town Meeting via Zoom on August 12th, which was held to discuss establishing a supervised consumption site in Somerville. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is produced for the Drug Truth Network and distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. Please support your local community and public radio stations. Become a member today. You can find this edition of Century of Lies, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. There's a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.